You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
You've probably never heard much from Psalm 18, although it has a lot in common with Psalm 46 that inspired Martin Luther's hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. While most scholars agree that it's an anonymous poem, King David gets the credit for writing this victory song, giving God all the credit for a triumph over one's enemies. There's a lot of schmoozing in Psalm 18, calling God the greatest ever, with language like, "Wow, God, you can do anything." But one thing it doesn't say is one single word about our theme for today, the inerrancy of the Bible. Not one word. But that doesn't stop desperate proponents of an inerrant Bible pointing to our lowly verse as more evidence that the Bible is perfect in every way, which it isn't. So, as we hear our passage today, take pity on the poor souls who have only one verse in the whole Bible, which they also misinterpret, to uphold their crazy idea. So, we're hearing this humble passage today out of pity, for it's being taken out of context by fundamentalists who are forced to strain to find anything that supports their unbiblical and irrational arguments.
Our words of wisdom are from the Psalms chapter 18, verse 30.
This God, his way is perfect. The promise of the Lord proves true. He is a shield for all who take refuge in him.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
On January 5th, 1995, MacArthur Wheeler and an accomplice strolled into a bank in Swissvale, Pennsylvania, and stole over $5,000. Doing nothing to conceal his face, MacArthur even smiled and waved at security cameras. What inspired such confidence? Having heard that lemon juice was used to make invisible ink, he had smeared his face with lemon juice, believing it would make his face invisible as well. He even attempted to calm and reassure one of the tellers by saying, "Don't be scared. I have a face. It's just invisible right now." Needless to say, the police put his picture on television and he was caught almost immediately. And when he was shown the security camera footage with his face fully in view, he was flabbergasted. Shaking his head in disbelief, he said, "But I wore the juice." Forrest Valkai, a science teacher I follow on TikTok, and you should totally check him out, points out this story's interesting postscript. The lemon juice bandits caught the attention of Cornell University psychologist David Dunning. Enlisting the help of a graduate student, Justin Kruger, they performed a series of experiments trying to find a correlation between the competence and the confidence of ordinary people. And what they discovered is a cognitive bias phenomena now called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Simply put, people who know just a little bit about a topic tend to think they're experts. And the less they know, the more adamant they are about their expertise. In other words, the people who know the least think they know the most. And herein lies the origin of perhaps the greatest divide among Christians, the authority of the Bible. The authority you place in the text of the Bible directly influences how you understand living the Christian life. So the fundamentalist argument goes, you've got to be able to trust that the text is totally true. Okay then, but what do you mean by true? What fundamentalists mean by true is dictated by God and totally, inerrantly factual. Here's how Fosdick framed the problem 100 years ago this weekend. Consider another matter on which there is a sincere difference of opinion between evangelical Christians, the inspiration of the Bible. One point of view is that the original documents of the scripture were inerrantly dictated by God to mortals. Whether we deal with the story of creation, or the list of the Dukes of Edom, or the narratives of Solomon's reign, or the Sermon on the Mount, or the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, they all came in the same way, and they all came as no other book ever came. They were inerrantly dictated. Everything there, scientific opinions, medical theories, historical judgments, as well as spiritual insight, is infallible. That's one idea of the Bible's inspiration. But side by side with those who hold it, lovers of the book as much as they are multitudes of people who never think about the Bible so. Indeed, that static and mechanical theory of inspiration seems to them a positive peril to the spiritual life. And where did this perilous, static, and mechanical theory of inspiration come from? From one lonely verse in the New Testament, 2 Timothy chapter 3. All scripture is inspired by God and is useful for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness. And this is the only verse that even vaguely refers to anything possibly having to do with inerrancy. Sorry, Psalm 18. But then you have to acknowledge 2 Timothy's overall lack of credibility, namely that it wasn't even written by who it claims to be written by. Starts out with, "I, Paul," but if you're familiar with Paul's actual writings, you know it is nothing like Paul. Then there's the whole inconvenience of historical critical analysis. Alas, when 2 Timothy was written, the only scripture around was Hebrew scripture, what Christians have called the Old Testament. There was no New Testament yet. So, when you hear someone reference this passage as proof that the whole Bible is perfect and inspired in every way, they clearly don't know what they're talking about, no matter how much lemon juice they've slathered on themselves. What is clear is that when 2 Timothy was written, somebody was up to something nefarious with Scripture. And sadly, those somebodies are still at work in evangelical and fundamentalist churches today. Just take a look at their What We Believe pages on their websites. The infallibility and inerrancy of Scripture is paramount. Just as a reminder, infallibility holds that Scripture is not misleading in any way. It's a sure, safe, and reliable rule and guide in all matters. And two, inerrancy is the quality of being free from any falsehoods or mistakes. Scripture is entirely true and trustworthy, historically, scientifically, sociologically, and spiritually. And then there are pronouncements like the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy that fundamentalists point to, claiming that Scripture is without error or fault in all its teaching, including how creation happened and events of world history. So, with Fosdick, I ask, where does that leave those of us who actually read our Bibles? What about all the stories in this so-called inerrant history book that just don't sink? Two creation stories, two flood stories, and no less than four authors' versions of the Exodus lurking in the book that we call Exodus. The narratives of Jesus' birth are in only two Gospels, and they don't have the same characters, timeline, or story emphasis. Matthew, Mark, and Luke portray Jesus' ministry as 1 year long, and John says it was 3 years long. So which is it? What about all the questionable rules and regulations in this infallible book from, say, Leviticus? You shouldn't plant two kinds of seed in the same field, nor two fibers in one cloth, or talk back to your parents, the penalty for which is death. What about Paul seemingly telling women to sit down and shut up, while at the same time supporting and celebrating Phoebe, Junia, and Prisca as female apostles? One of my favorites is the book of Joshua, where the sun is portrayed as revolving around the earth. There's some science for you. And let's not even talk about all the ways that God is portrayed as a misogynist, racist practitioner of genocide. Look, I'm not trying to discredit the Bible. Far from it. I've dedicated my professional life to understanding the source and meaning of Scripture. And that means two things. One, thinking critically about Scripture, the very thing fundamentalists dread most. And two, actually reading the Bible, the antithesis of anyone wanting to perfect their practice of the Dunning-Kruger effect. They're afraid that if they admit that there are contradictions in the Bible, then the whole thing has to be dismissed as a worthless lie. What they forget is that 70% of the words of Jesus in the Gospels are fiction. What? Absolutely. Parables, metaphors, and stories. Are they all to be dismissed because they're not factual? When John Dominic Crossan tells his story about Lincoln High School, he paints a picture of an idyllic tree-lined street at the end of which looms the marble colonnaded entrance of the school. The foot of the stairs is a large statue of the school's namesake, Abraham Lincoln. And in front of Lincoln is a large tree stump. Kneeling on the other side of the stump from Lincoln, eyes looking up in hope and expectation, is an African-American slave. The slave's arms are stretched wide so that the chains linking his wrists rest on the top of the stump. Feet planted firmly, lumberjack Lincoln stands poised with an axe above his head, ready to come down and shatter the chains of the slave. The question he then asks is, did this happen? Well, no, not literally. It's not factual. But is it true? Absolutely. Likewise, most of the Bible is not factual. But through metaphor, parable, and artistic representations, it often expresses profound truths better than raw historical data. And yeah, there's also a lot of propaganda that just needs to be ditched as outdated. But you get the picture, right? So why does any of this matter, you ask? In short, because fundamentalists are ruining the Bible, Christianity, and Jesus for everybody else. Where I'd like to think people will know we are Christians by our love, the reality is that fundamentalists have created a culture where most people associate Christians by what they hate. It's hard to believe, but it was 7 years ago now that eight other churches in Fountain Hills banded together in a series of sermons on, you guessed it, the five fundamentals. Out of fear over LGBTQ inclusivity, interfaith dialogue, and contemporary understandings of Jesus' life promoted by the Fountains, eight churches in Fountain Hills decided to do exactly what Jesus would want them to do. Gang up on those who are different and demonize them as heretical, apostate, and dangerous. If you don't remember, you can Google it. The whole episode garnered the Fountains international publicity. One of my favorite blog posts was by author John Shore, who dubbed the other churches the Gang of Eight. He observed that this was more mature than what he wanted to call them in the first place, which was churches rallying against progress, or crap. John wrote on his blog, "And if there's one message the Gang of Eight is successfully communicating, it's that they're feeling threatened. threatened they are, and threatened they should be. For the Christianity they represent is, in a word, ruinous. It holds that the unrepentant LGBT person is destined for hell, that wives must be subservient to their husbands, and that Christians alone can enjoy a heavenly afterlife. The Christianity they preach and teach feeds off fear, exclusivity, anger, and victimizing the other. And right now, in Fountain Hills, Arizona, that other is the Fountains UMC. The good news is that the bullying backfired. The unanticipated consequence of the fact or fiction campaign included a sincere interest in the principles of progressive Christianity by people who had never known there was an alternative to fundamentalism. And if you think they learned their lesson, you'd be wrong. A few weeks ago, when the pastor of our local Baptist church read about our Shall the Fundamentalists Win series, he wrote a rebuttal, which the local paper refused to print. So then he went after the Fountain Hills Times, implying they are a tool of liberal mainstream media and its un-American commitment to cancel culture. He then went on a tear on Facebook saying, "This upcoming series celebrates the teachings from heretic Harry Emerson Fosdick. People have a clear choice on which kind of church they attend. The choice either to be involved in a church that holds to biblical truth or one that promotes heresy disguised as truth, based on the authority of theologians who have corrupt minds. Those who teach the denial of the fundamentals of the faith, such as the virgin birth, inerrancy of the scriptures, the substitutionary atonement, the resurrection, and the second coming, by claiming clear evidence to the contrary, show both their ignorance of essential and eternal truth and their rejection of Christ." He then went on to threaten physical violence against those who don't believe what he says with, "When everything is done, what God has declared will be so, regardless of what any religious reprobate teaches. Make your choice. The choice could not be more clear. Your eternal soul hangs in the balance." Well, then after threatening violence, calling what we're doing heretical and corrupt, and calling me a reprobate, which is a technical term in Calvinist theology that means a person who God has damned to hell, he made sure to add, "We need to be careful to not judge someone's eternal soul. That belongs to the Lord, the perfect judge." Thanks. Fosdick had a word about this 100 years ago. Here in the Christian church today are these two groups, and the question which the fundamentalists have raised is this: shall one of them drive the other out? Do we think the cause of Jesus Christ will be furthered by that? If he should walk through the ranks of this congregation this morning, can we imagine him claiming as his own those who hold one idea of inspiration, and sending from him into outer darkness those who hold another? You cannot fit the Lord Christ into that fundamentalist mold. As Kurt Struckmeyer taught us in his book, A Conspiracy of Love, the choice really is between committing yourself to the fundamentalist gospel about Jesus or choosing to put love first by practicing the gospel of Jesus. I honestly believe that there are countless people out there for whom the message you and I share would be like a breath of fresh air, but they just haven't heard it. And when they do, they just can't believe there really is a movement that welcomes all people, that respects other religions, that works for justice, that seeks to confront racism and prejudice in all its forms, and works to heal the world. All of which begins with, as Paul Tillich insisted, taking the Bible seriously and not literally. Look, as the best-selling, least-read book of all time, The Bible needs to be re-examined by most of us. It's not something to be believed in as though it has some magical powers, but to be in relationship with, as one would be with any person or cause or issue to which we give allegiance in this life. The last thing we need to do is be in denial about the Bible's flaws and shortcomings. We deal with them every week by being honest about them and what they say about the Bible's origins, authority, and influence. So, going forward, we also need to acknowledge with compassion the very real fear of eternal punishment that most fundamentalists live with every day. They genuinely believe that an angry God is going to torture them for not believing the right stuff. They're good people who have been caught up in an archaic worldview and spellbound by pastors who either know just enough about the topic to think they're experts or who feel just as trapped as many of their parishioners. It's like they're in a negative feedback loop of doom that's masquerading as love. They really are stuck. So, with love, let's remember. They're not crazy, but they might think that lemons can make them invisible. Friends, as progressive Christians, we are not manacled to a literal and stagnant interpretation of the Bible. We have the freedom to loosen our grip on the obsession with certainty and work with people of other faiths and other perspectives to adapt our understandings toward embracing a core value that Jesus taught his first followers, expanding our spiritual horizons beyond rigid literalism. Together, we can model going deeper, asking the tough questions, and exploring the ways the Bible can still be a catalyst, not for oppression, institutionalizing prejudice, injustice, and rigidity, but for new freedoms and spiritual directions. Despite our noisy and fearful critics, I believe we not only can, we must be a beacon of what it looks like to take the Bible seriously and not literally, so that together we can put love first and reclaim what following Jesus is all about. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.wepuTLoveFirst.org.